Welcome to the Ogletree Deacons Podcast, a brief discussion of compelling legal issues and practical insights. Please note that the information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be, nor should it be construed as legal advice. You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts or through your favorite podcast service. Please consider rating and reviewing so that we may continue to provide the content that covers your needs. Please enjoy the program.
Hello, and welcome to the Ogletree Deacons COVID-19 Litigation Podcast. I'm your host, Ashley Cutnow. I'm a partner in Ogletree Deacons, Greenville, South Carolina office, and I'm the co-chair of the COVID-19 Litigation Practice Group. Our topic today surrounds COVID-19 litigation and labor relations. With me today is Bindu Gross. Bindu's practice focuses on labor relations with an emphasis on traditional labor matters, as well as workplace safety and health law, including assisting employers before the Occupational Safety and Health Review Commission. So Bindu has been perfectly placed to help our clients work through issues surrounding labor relations and COVID-19. You know, Bindu, sometimes I think employers believe the NLRA only applies to them if they are unionized. Can you help me dispel that myth for our listeners?
Absolutely, Ashley. I'm happy to help there. And that's something that, as you can imagine, we come across a lot in Texas because it's a right to work state. And a lot of private sector employers are not unionized. But it's that myth is exactly that. There are aspects of the National Labor Relations Act that do have implications even on non-union employers. And one thing to keep in mind is that the NLRA through Section 7 does apply to most private employers. There are a few exceptions, so government employers, it doesn't apply, and employers who are in the agricultural section. But by far, it has a pretty broad-ranging application. And if you don't mind, I'll just elaborate on the Section 7 aspect of it. That does relate to scenarios where the National Labor Relations Board, who enforces the National Labor Relations Act, does police private employers who are not organized for actions where employees may make statements that the National Labor Relations Board will interpret that have an implication or that impact the employee's ability to organize or to form a union or to express concerns about their terms and conditions of employment that affect two or more employees.
And, you know, and I think sometimes employers forget about that aspect of the NLRA, especially in states. You know, I'm here in South Carolina. We, for the most part, have a fairly low unionized rate, but we have seen a good bit of union activities at employers who've never seen it before since COVID-19 has begun. And I think that's exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, you can run a couple of searches and you'll find that unions, in part because they're in the private sector, they've been trending downward in terms of membership. So as you can imagine, they're looking for ways to stay relevant. And they've really taken COVID-19 as a perfect opportunity. It's a ready-made issue that by its nature, it's kind of a galvanizing issue, or it's an issue that impacts broad sectors of society, and let alone the workforce. And there are websites, union organizing websites, where electronically they'll essentially have almost like a campaign in a box, or they'll have a protected concerted activity in a box, sort of a 101 on how to express concerns in the workplace and position oneself in a way where you're protected or insulated from employer action, or where you're making it more difficult for an employer to enforce their rules. And the byproduct of that, of course, is the union is using it as a sales pitch. Hey, give us your personal information and we can use this as a recognition card. They're not, or an interest card. They're not necessarily framing their communications with those words, but that really is the practical impact of when employees are sharing that personal information with unions.
That's right. And now, can you tell me a little bit, have unions become active in the actual litigation space since the start of COVID-19?
Certainly, and we've seen it take place or materialize in a couple of different forms. One of the first examples that comes to mind is there's a fairly large union, international union, and they're trying to organize fast food employer, very large employer. And so what the union has done is they've taken this opportunity to fund different litigation or lawsuits that are targeting the specific employer. And they're targeting issues that you can imagine impact broad sectors. So whether it's, hey, we're alleging that the employer is not providing proper PPE, personal protective equipment, or that they are not providing employees with the appropriate rate of pay, or if it almost seems like a distant memory here, but the fight for 15, it's something that blends very easily here, or demanding hazard pay. We've also seen in the organized sector that unions have filed lawsuits that if you've been through the grievance and arbitration process, it typically moves certainly slower than the pandemic has moved. And so a lot of unions have also taken to filing suits under the Labor Management Rights Act to try to expedite the arbitration process. Another example that we've seen is that they've also tried to file to gain access to an employer's facilities if their collective bargaining agreement doesn't per se give them that right.
You know, those are some interesting tactics that the unions are using, again, because of COVID-19 and this unique position that we're in. Well, what about employees? Are we seeing an increase in unfair labor practices or other types of kind of complaints, claims under the NLRA?
Certainly. And just as a reminder, hearkening back to what we were discussing earlier, we're certainly seeing this in the National Labor Relations Board sector, whether employees are working in a organized or a non-union setting. Employees are definitely availing themselves of agency help, self-help, if you will. And that includes the National Labor Relations Board. And also using that example of the union organizing tactic where they're giving folks the sort of the 101, here's how you can establish that you're engaging in protected concerted activity. There have been a number of unfair labor practice charges filed where employees make allegations along the lines of safety concerns or personal protective equipment. Here's another one that's I personally think is kind of a novel or an interesting spin to these concerns is even in scenarios where, just from a general sense, as most of you probably already know, the National Labor Relations Act does not affect or does not apply to supervisory employees. There is a recent unfair labor practice charge that was filed by employees in a bargaining unit that did not involve any employment action against them per se, but it involved management's decision to reopen the workplace, and they had a sector of their supervisors who were in disagreement with what the reopening plan was. And so management in response fired those supervisors. And so the unfair labor practice charge alleged that by doing that, by taking that action, the employer is actually chilling the Section 7 rights of those employees in the bargaining unit. So it was having an impact or the way that the employees in the bargaining unit would interpret those actions is that they were going to be discouraged from engaging in that collective bargaining process or engaging their employer in discussions or open discussions about their safety concerns. So you can see how it can really morph into a number of different directions. Time will tell how the National Labor Relations Board processes that unfair labor practice charge, but it's another item to keep in mind as employers are making decisions in the workplace.
That's right. And I know you mentioned timing earlier, Bindu, but how are we seeing a delay in how quickly things are moving through the National Relations Board? Are they moving faster or slower because of COVID-19? Or do we even have a feel for that yet?
I would say a couple of aspects to or answers to that question. One is I would remind there hasn't been a change to the statute of limitations. An employee is going to have the 6 months to file an unfair labor practice charge for whatever it is that they allege was unlawful. In terms of how the regions or how quickly regions are processing unfair labor practice charges, I would say that with the less controversial ones, ones that have fewer witnesses and that are fairly straightforward, At least my experience has been that the board, even though they're now working virtually, they are processing them fairly quickly. Like other, similar to other agencies, they're pretty thin in terms of within the ranks in terms of they're receiving a lot of different complaints from a lot of different directions. But I think practically what that means is that they're also tending to dismiss claims that in the past they may have held on to longer, but quicker in the pre-complaint stage. And just to, as a general overview, they, as you typically know, an unfair labor practice charge, that's not something that the NLRB can start sua sponte. You typically have to start that with a charging party, whether it be an individual employee or a union. Then the NLRB, the region at the regional level, will intake that, process it, and then as part of that process, will contact the employer and try to get evidence from the employer. But in terms of the timing, it's been fairly quick. They'll conduct an investigation and then determine whether if there is merit to the complaint, they might issue an actual complaint. And then that starts the NLRB's litigation. Well, I wouldn't say it starts. It continues that litigation mechanism into the next stage, which usually will involve an administrative law judge. But to answer your question briefly, I would say yes, the timing has been a little bit quicker. And if you have, if you find yourself in a situation where you're responding to something where you think the complaint has little to no merit, it now's a good time to try to be fairly aggressive early on to respond with your, put your best foot forward and hopefully get that dismissed early.
You know, and Bindu, why don't we give our listeners a couple of hypotheticals here that we've seen from charges that have been filed or from advice memorandums that have been issued from the board. So, you know, one big issue that is currently happening is everybody is reopening post-shutdown, right? What happens if you have, let's say, the following scenario? The employer reopens post-shutdown. They direct all of the employees to return, but your one employee and a controller have, let's say, a health issue. The employee will talk with the controller about their risk, and the employee insists on working from home and says he cannot come back into the office. The employer decides to fire the employee. Is that an NLRA violation?
That's an excellent fact pattern, Ashley, and that's something that actually the general counsel for the NLRB has recently addressed. And in that specific case, the NLRB or the general counsel determined that the behavior was not protected concerted activity. Just from a very high level, there are a couple of key points or key takeaways I would highlight there. Make sure that when you become aware of scenarios like that, when employees are expressing their concerns, they have a good understanding of who they have communicated with and what the nature of their concerns are. In that specific setting, the employee really made complaints or expressed concerns that were relative to that specific employee. And that was a very large reason why the general counsel determined, or I suspect, I don't want to speak for him, but the fact that the complaint was geared towards that specific health concern strongly suggested that there were the complaint did not impact or did not involve fellow employees. So I think that's what resulted in that specific decision. I'll tweak the facts a little bit just for the sake of discussion. We've also received some advice memorandums that talk about scenarios where employees, let's say in a nursing home, you have two employees, one employee who's claiming concerns about returning to work because they're self-imposing a quarantine based on the fact that while they were working for a separate employer, they thought they were exposed to COVID-19. So table that employee, let's call that employee one. And then you have employee two who is expressing concerns about, hey, I'm not really happy about your reopening plan. I don't like the way that you're creating or that you're using gowns that are personal protective equipment. You're also, as part of your plan, you're requesting that we reuse some of our PPE. I'm not comfortable with this. I've talked to other coworkers about it. I've alerted my supervisor. Oh, and by the way, I'm considering calling a union, and maybe they can do something that'll help me. Now, I would caution, you want to be really careful, and you want to be confident or that you understand the facts prior to making an employment decision. Because, so here's a spoiler alert, the general counsel found that those actions I just described were also not protected concerted activity. But you can think about very easy ways where, for example, if the employee had engaged a union or they were following a 101, they might be thinking about, well, what was the timing of my communications with coworkers? When I communicated my concerns to the employer, was I thinking about how I could implicate others? The short version of the general counsel's analysis was that the employee two, was not seeking to engage their coworkers in group action, that even though they had taken certain steps that would suggest that they were speaking on behalf of others, they really were not, and they really keyed in on what the communications were between the employee and their supervisor. So these are going to be pretty fact-specific analysis, but you do want to be very careful and cognizant of what was said, what the context was, and what your rules are as well, and whether or not you're being consistent in how you enforce those.
That's right. And, you know, and just like everything with COVID-19, it seems like nothing is quite as simple as you want it to be. So, of course, we're talking on this podcast specific to kind of labor relations and the NLRA, but you also have to always consider, you know, does your fact pattern impact OSHA or the new FFCRA or any kind of state laws that are out there also, and really have a broad spectrum view of it to make sure you're doing everything properly. So, Bindu, let me ask you one last question before we end our podcast today. You know, one thing that I have seen happen to several of my clients personally is unions making requests for information that my client considers confidential. Things like, how many of your employees have tested positive for COVID-19? Those types of questions. What are, you know, the rules around unions and these requests for confidential information?
Ashley, we've seen that a lot here too. Generally speaking, my rule of thumb there is, number one, you definitely want to make sure that you respond, so that you don't want to get caught in the switches of, well, the employer refused to bargain with the union because they didn't even respond. So even if your response is, I'm objecting to specific concerns, at least you want to be able to say, I responded. The second part of it is you've highlighted a very nuanced area, which does come up quite a bit. And what you'd want to do, or what I always recommend, is to have a dialogue with the union about what it is that they're specifically seeking and what's the purpose behind it. I think that you can certainly push back, especially on the confidentiality side, because you're looking at an intersection of, it's not just the obligations of, under the National Labor Relations Act, but confidentiality also has implications, as you know, through the Americans with Disability Act, might be some FMLA implications, and you might even have some state-based causes of action. So you do want to tread carefully and balance all of those things with your obligations under the NLRA. So it might be a scenario where, depending on what the union is trying to accomplish, and if they're asking for information that relates to bargaining unit employees, you can think of very numerous ways where they can easily establish that it's probably information that's relevant for them to exercise their right as exclusive bargaining representative of bargaining unit employees. So number one is engaging them, responding. Number two is probably having a conversation to better understand what the nature is of their request and what the purpose is of what they're trying to achieve. If you decide that it is something, or it's a situation where you probably want to provide some of that information, you might be in a position where you redact the personal information. I mean, I can tell you, I believe that they'd be hard-pressed to establish, for example, that they absolutely positively must have Social Security numbers or access to medical records without a waiver from the specific employee that says, yeah, we're I, the employee, am okay with you disclosing these specifics? Is it something that you might be able to accommodate and balance all of those concerns with providing more generalized information? So whether it be redacted information or a chart of some of the records that you might have. So really the takeaway there is engage in sort of an interactive process and try to determine what that is. And also remember that you have recourse. You might consider reaching a confidentiality agreement if it is that you're sharing information that includes personal and identifying information of your specific employees.
Well, Bindu, you know, thank you so much for your insights today. We really appreciate it. I think the NLRA is an area of the law where, you know, if you're in a non-unionized setting, our employer clients don't always really have a good handle on it. And this is a great insights into some of the key issues that we're seeing come up with COVID-19 and things that people need to be aware of and to keep in the forefront of their minds as they're dealing with the COVID-19 related issues in the workplace. Thank you so much for joining us today. We hope you'll join us for our next podcast as we continue our COVID-19 series into the future. Thanks so much for listening.
Thank you for joining us on the Ogletree Deacons podcast. You can subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or through your favorite podcast service. Please consider rating and reviewing so that we may continue to provide the content that covers your needs. And remember, the information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not to be construed as legal advice.